This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. A generation ago, we got an inside look at the Nixon-McGovern campaign thanks to Timothy Krause. He wrote The Boys on the Bus. A good deal has changed since that 1972 campaign. There are now a lot of women on board that bus. Typewriters are long gone. So too mad dashes for a telephone to file stories. But much remains the same. The days are long. There are stories to write, deadlines to meet. Before long, reporters can recite the stump speech in their sleep, while gaining access to the candidate can remain a nightmare. Associated Press reporter Beth Harp has covered Hillary Clinton's historic campaign for the U.S. Senate. And she's written a book about Clinton's campaign and what it's like for a reporter today to be out on the campaign trail. The title is The Girls in the Van, Covering Hillary. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Beth Harp. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Beth Harp has been a writer for the AP since 1988. She's covered just about every kind of story. She covered Hillary Clinton when the then First Lady began visiting New York and continued reporting on her through the campaign. Her book about the campaign, The Girls in the Van, is published by St. Martin's Press. And by the way, Beth will be in the Chicago area late next month on Monday, January 28th. She'll be at Borders on Michigan Avenue in Chicago for a reading that evening on Monday the 28th. And on Wednesday the 30th, she'll be doing a reading and talk at Barnes & Noble in Evanston. That's set for 7 p.m. And I believe you can find out more about her schedule if you're interested at the website www.girlsinthevan.com. www.girlsinthevan.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Beth Harpaz, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Do you remember the first time you covered a story involving Hillary Clinton?
I had covered her a couple of times as First Lady over the years, you know, the first 6 years of her husband's administration. But there wasn't really much of a fuss made about it. I mean, normally a First Lady, you know, drops into a city for an hour or two and does a kind of a puff piece event. I think I covered her once at a hospital. You know, she was looking at some kind of a new program there, and maybe once or twice at other events like that. But the first time that I covered her in relation to a sort of overtly political matter was when Chuck Schumer was running against Al D'Amato, and that was back in the fall of 98. And it was a big priority for the Clinton administration to get rid of D'Amato and get Schumer in. They were in the process of losing some seats in the Senate. It was really important to get that New York seat, and D'Amato was vulnerable because he'd had some, you know, ethical scandals going on. So they brought Hillary in a couple of times that fall to stump for Chuck Schumer. And what I remember was this was all during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, you know, was in the paper every single day. And it was incredible, the outpouring of love and support for Hillary at those events for Chuck Schumer. I mean, you could not get people to stop clapping or to stop cheering. I remember going to a union hall in Manhattan. There were probably a couple thousand people there. And the ovation just went on and on and on. Hillary, Hillary. And you could see from her demeanor how overwhelmed she was with this outpouring for her, because, you know, this was at a time when she was so humiliated by the revelations surrounding the Lewinsky scandal and, you know, all that was going on, you know, in President Clinton's personal life and the revelations about it. And the love was just nonstop. And, I mean, I really think that that must have planted a little seed in her brain that, hey, I could make a new life for myself here because these people really love me.
Yeah. I wonder what those moments were like for Mr. Schumer.
You know, because it was not clear that he was going to win D'Amato, I mean, in the end he did win by a comfortable margin, I think that he was thrilled to have the attention from the White House because it was bringing him a lot of money and it was bringing him a lot of media and, you know, it was making him look like a winner. And for him to be next to someone who was so popular at that time could only help him. Of course, you know, now things are a little bit different with Hillary as the junior senator. There was a lot of speculation that Senator Schumer, who became is now the senior senator since he was elected before Hillary, you know, that there would be some resentment and maybe some jostling for the limelight. How do you compete with a former first lady, the only first lady to ever win elective office, the only woman to ever win statewide office in New York? But I think that Hillary's been very careful in her first year as senator not to outshine Schumer. She's done a lot of events with him, and I noticed she's been very careful often to let him speak first. It's almost like she's trying to be really sensitive not to step on his toes, to say, okay, I recognize you were here first, you were in the Senate first, you have a lot to say too, you're important too, I'm not going to hog it. So maybe at that time, I don't think that there was that dynamic. I think he was truly grateful to have her support. Mm-hmm. And now I think there's probably a little more competition going on.
Was it difficult for you as a reporter and the other reporters covering Hillary's Senate campaign to go from seeing her as this sympathetic figure where people feel in so much sympathy with her because of the situation that she was facing at home with her husband, and all the aura of First Lady, where she'd been seen for a number of years in places like hospitals and libraries and grade schools and that kind of thing. Is it difficult to switch to from covering that kind of a person to covering someone who is making a run for the U.S. Senate?
It was very hard for us at first. It was part of what made it hard was that she had a full Secret Service contingent, which, you know, any first lady or president would have. Normally, someone running for Senate or mayor or governor does not have multiple layers of security. In a typical campaign, when I covered Schumer and D'Amato, for example, you could walk right up to them if you were a reporter and ask a question. If a subject did not get covered at a news conference, or if there was a late-breaking development and you needed a comment on it, it was not a big deal. You could just walk over and say, hey, something came up, can I just ask you, blah, blah, blah. No problem. With Hillary, we physically could not get close enough to her for months during this campaign to even have our questions heard. Everything was tightly controlled. And it took a while for us in the press corps to break out of the mold of just kind of succumbing to this security stuff, you know, stand back, you can't ask her a question, blah, 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 blah. I remember very clearly one day we were in a suburban school and there had been a school shooting elsewhere in the country. And, you know, that was the big story of the day. We needed a comment from her as First Lady, as Senate candidate. She wasn't holding a press conference that day. And at one point during the day, she was a few feet away from the press corps within earshot. And we kept thinking, okay, she's going to come over and say something to us about this, something we can put in our stories, and she never did. And I remember one of my colleagues who was working for ABC News, Eileen Murphy, saying, you know, we're still treating her like a first lady. And that sort of made the light bulb in my head go off, and I just kind of swore to myself then and there, that's it. From now on, I'm just shouting my question. I don't care how inappropriate it is. I don't care what her staff says about, oh, we're not taking questions today. I'm just going to ask the question. If she doesn't want to answer it, that's fine. And I just kind of made it a practice after that to just, you know, ignore the Secret Service. I mean, not to the point where I was going to get taken out by them, but, you know, to just do what I had to do. I mean, when you're covering a campaign, you try to put yourself in the shoes of the voter and say, what does the voter need to know today to make a decision about whether or not to vote for this candidate? And that usually means, you know, commenting on the story of the day, or if something has come up about the candidate's past, or, you know, maybe the candidate is pushing some kind of an issue and you want to question them about that. But it did take a while, you know, because there was a certain formality associated with a first lady, a little bit like a queen or something. And typically a first lady is not fair game the way someone running for office is. Typically you wouldn't pepper that person with hard questions. But, you know, once they say, I'm running for office, I want people to vote for me, then it is different, and they are fair game, and they do have to be willing to take whatever questions the press corps needs to ask.
Mm. Did covering this campaign have an effect on you as a reporter? In other words, do you see your job differently today than you did in 1999?
I don't think so. I think it made me, unfortunately, a little bit more cynical than I had been. You know, when you cover politics up close, you see that it is a game to a lot of the people who are working on the campaigns on both sides. And, you know, there were times when you know, when games were being played, when each side was saying something about the other side that was just kind of silly, you know, they would, each side was guilty of this, they would dig up some obscure sentence that the opponent had said years before and then issue a press release about it. And, I mean, as a reporter, you just kind of shake your head and say, you know, what planet are these people on? Get real. Nobody cares about this. It's meaningless. You know, so that, I think that probably affected me personally. In the end, I actually wasn't able to, I didn't vote in the election. I just felt like I just knew so much about both of these candidates that the reality of who I thought would be the best senator just couldn't, I couldn't make that decision anymore. So that was unfortunate. But such is life. There are lots of Americans out there who feel cynical about politics, and I guess I understand why now in a way that maybe I didn't before.
Wow. Does that cynicism continue for you in terms of how you view campaigns, and is it difficult for you now to be given a candidate assignment?
No, because I think unless you're up close, at least for me, unless I'm up close and really steeped and immersed in every little detail, I can make decisions, you know, for what's good for me as a New Yorker. I live in New York City and a parent. I have two small children, you know, and an American. And the issues, you know, are somehow clearer when I'm not completely immersed in it. But when I'm doing it 24/7, you know, and I'm thinking, I know everything about these people, including their birthdays, their favorite colors, what they studied in college, where they met their husband or wife, you know, they cease to become, you know, objective to me in any way. I can't sort of make a rational decision about them. And actually, it's interesting. A lot of reporters, probably less because of cynicism and more because they want to try to be fair. Many political reporters abstain from voting in elections that they're writing about. It's a sort of a point of honor with a lot of political reporters that in order to you know, show that they're truly trying to be fair about a candidate, they make a sort of pledge to themselves at the beginning of the campaign that they're not actually going to pull the lever for that line on the ballot, whatever it might be.
Yeah. To follow up on this, the campaigns are a theater. The locations are scouted. The photo ops are planned. What will be the backdrop? The speech is ready, is scripted. What's it like to be able to recite the candidate's lines as though you're taking part, you know, in an audience participation kind of a thing in a theater?
I think probably most people could relate to this because it's something that they did when they were in high school or in summer camp or even at the Thanksgiving table when, you know, Uncle So-and-so comes over and tells the story of, you know, whatever in the family that he's told 100 times before, and everybody just kind of rolls their eyes and mumbles the story along with the speaker. You know, campaigns are theater, and one of the things that I wanted to capture in this book is just how much fun it can be. My book is not a dry, boring, political tome with a lot of heavy analysis. It's about the day-to-day absurdity, the fun and games, the bad food, the silly songs, the inside jokes, you know, as you said, the speech that you know by heart. I wanted to give people a feeling of what is it like to actually be on the press fan and, you know, sort of be inside the media. You know, everything from how do we decide what is the lead of a story to what did we leave out of a story to, you know, what do we write when we're really not sure what's going on, which, you know, occasionally will happen. You're just really not sure what message the candidate was trying to get across, or some question comes up and you just can't resolve it in your own mind. Also, the camaraderie of being in the press, and, you know, as I said, summer camp is a good analogy. By the end of the campaign, I really felt like the other reporters, especially the women, and there were a lot of women covering Hillary, which is not typical for a political campaign. Typically, if you went in a press end, most of the reporters would be men. But in Hillary's campaign, most of the reporters were women. And there was a real sorority feeling. It was actually wonderful. I mean, you know, as I said, I'm a working mother. You know, we'd show pictures of our kids. We'd sit around and analyze Hillary's outfit for the day, her lipstick color. It was really fun. And, you know, there'd be like 3 donuts. We'd be dividing them into little tiny pieces to get us through the day. So I wanted to capture that kind of fun and games aspect. And I also wanted to show people, to the extent that I could, whatever side of Hillary that I thought maybe isn't well known. For example, she has a fabulous sense of humor. She's very funny, and she actually can laugh at herself, which, you know, astounded me. That was a revelation to me that she is self-aware enough and, you know, sort of has enough humility that she can take a joke and she can make a joke about herself. And so I wanted to try to bring out some of those things that maybe didn't make it into the headlines.
Were there a majority, the women covering Hillary, you said that, you know, most of the reporters, the political reporters covering Hillary were women. Was it because Hillary was a woman that more women were assigned to cover her?
It's a good question. I was not able to find any editors who would admit to me, oh, yeah, I assigned a woman to cover Hillary because I thought a woman would do a better job covering a female candidate. It would probably be illegal to admit that anybody had done that, right? But I will merely share with you the facts, which are that, you know, if you went on the Lazio press bus, remember after Mayor Giuliani dropped out of the Senate race, he was replaced by a congressman from Long Island named Rick Lazio, Republican congressman. And if you went on the Lazio bus, there would be, you know, 15 men and 2 women. And that's pretty typical for a political campaign. If you're covering, you know, times when I've covered presidential candidates or mayor's race or governor's race, it's pretty typical for most of the reporters to be men. I'll let your listeners make their own conclusions about why that might be. But when you went on the Hillary van, it was mostly women. And like I say, I don't know if editors consciously made a decision or if subconsciously they just looked around the newsroom and said, oh, you know, there's a woman. I think I'll have her go cover Hillary, and it just accidentally evolved that way. I mean, I had covered the Schumer-D'Amato campaign, so in my case, it made sense for me to sort of continue with the Senate coverage of Hillary's campaign. You know, there were women covering this campaign who had not covered politics before, who were feature writers or covered other subjects for their media outlets. And maybe they brought a fresh perspective that, you know, a hard-bitten political reporter might not have. I don't know that our stories were necessarily different in the end, but I think that sometimes the conversations we had were different. I think sometimes the style was different. One of the examples, one of my favorite stories from the campaign is the day I had a conversation with Hillary about potty training my 2-year-old. There's a famous book called Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail by Hunter Thompson from the 70s, in which he has a conversation about football with Richard Nixon. And, you know, I noticed that a lot of politicians talk about sports with reporters, and I have no interest in sports. The Yankees won the World Series. I couldn't name one player in the Yankees, okay? I'm not saying that's typical of women, but that's me. And so, you know, I ended up having this little chat with Hillary about potty training. It came up very innocently. And as we were having this discussion, I thought, oh, this is really stupid. I've made a fool of myself. You know, I'm talking about potty training with the First Lady. But then it became clear to me that she was kind of interested in this subject, and she didn't think it was stupid or weird at all. And then to my incredible astonishment, the correspondent for our CBS affiliate used this conversation as the lead item on the CBS news that night at 11 o'clock, you know, to the point where my mother-in-law was calling me on the phone saying, you know, why is Hillary talking about potty training Nathaniel? You know, and I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And then I realized the cameras had been rolling. They caught this piece of tape, and this correspondent, who of course was a woman, said, you know what? This is actually newsworthy. Why? Because it shows that Hillary is human. You know, it shows that she can connect with a working mother on just a very human level about an issue that is every mother, every parent has to deal with, this issue of potty training. And I often think of that as sort of my equivalent of, you know, Hunter Thompson, Richard Nixon, and football. Me, Hillary Clinton, and potty training. I mean, potty training can be a political issue. Why? Because daycare centers won't take your child unless they're potty trained. And if you're a working parent, it's actually hard to potty train your kid. I had to take a vacation in order to potty train my child. I'm not saying it's not my job. It is. It's my responsibility as a parent. But it's, you know, it's related to the issue of working women. It's related to the issue of child care and daycare. And ultimately, it's related to the issue of our economy. If you can't get that kid potty trained, then you can't go to law school and you can't go to work. And, you know, that's about it. You're home till that kid is potty trained. So, you know, I think that in some there were certainly ways in which, as I said, the conversation was different. The substance of what we talked about, what we focused on, was different than if it had been all men. We might have been talking about the Yankees or football. And sometimes the style was different, you know. And another one of my favorite stories is Anna Quinlan, who now writes a column for Newsweek. She used to work for the New York Times. She was one of the first women to cover City Hall. And she once wrote that she was worried that all the good stories at City Hall were happening in the men's room, because it was male reporters and a male mayor and his male staff, and they'd all go in the men's room. And, you know, she was sitting all by herself thinking, oh, my God, am I missing the big story? So, of course, we have Hillary. We could follow her into the ladies' room. This was, you know, such an exciting possibility. But I'm here to tell you that I don't think anyone ever got a big story in the ladies' room. A couple people did follow her in. As far as I know, no news was divulged. I'm not sure that news is ever divulged when men are in the men's room either. It's just our paranoia that that's happening. I remember one day one of my colleagues coming out of the ladies' room and saying, oh, you know, Hillary was in there, and I just walked out. I just couldn't deal with it. Did I do the wrong thing? Was I supposed to get a big scoop? And I just said, no, you know, you were human. You did the human thing. You gave the woman her, like, 2 minutes of privacy. You know, if she can't have privacy in the ladies' room, where could she have privacy? And, you know, some people have suggested that men might have reacted differently, that men might have said, oh, you blew it, you jerk. You know, you had your moment to get a scoop, and you didn't get it. And instead, we were all kind of supportive, like, well, you know, of course, if you're in the bathroom with her, you're not supposed to be asking her about Whitewater. Like, that's just tacky. I guess that's kind of a long answer to your question, but, you know, like I said, I think in some ways it made a difference that there was such a sort of a female atmosphere.
Yeah, I wonder, though, you know, maybe it would just depend on the circumstance and the situation, and maybe you would do an interview in the ladies' room, whether it was Hillary or some other newsmaker who happened to be a woman and you were there. I think it's, you know, it's...
It might depend, you know, if you thought... If you thought you had no other chance in the world.
Or at least you could say, could I talk to you, you know, here, you know, after we leave the ladies' room.
You know, I think also it might have just been that, like, with Hillary, you know, and this maybe goes back to what you were mentioning earlier, you know, covering someone who'd been through Monica and all of that. And I'm not saying that we gave her some special treatment because of that. But you were always aware of the fact that here is a woman whose most private secrets have been on the front page of every newspaper in the world. You know, that we all know more about Hillary and Bill and what goes on behind closed doors than just about any other politicians. I sometimes wonder if maybe we, you know, something like a ladies' room encounter, that you just sort of got the feeling, well, you know, here's someone whose privacy has been so violated. The least I can do is just let her do this without me standing in here with her. That may have been a factor, too.
Yeah. Well, in a situation like this, you're tempted to always be on the job, but then also you're a human being, and the people that you're covering, whether it's the police beat or politics, the State House, Congress, whatever, you know, those folks are human beings as well, and I'm not saying that a reporter should cut them slack when there's a story to be done, but at the same time, there are moments when it seems to me that, you know, just leave it alone.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, another one of my colleagues said it at one time, you never got the feeling that you saw the real Hillary. There were very few opportunities for a very casual personal interaction. I mean, they happened occasionally, but even when they happened, even when she, you know, one day it was her birthday, we all sang her happy birthday, we gave her a little cupcake with a candle in it, and, you know, and she made a few jokes, and it, you know, it was just a few minutes, and it was nice because it wasn't scripted, it wasn't a press conference, it was just kind of her relating to us. This was towards the end of the campaign, so we all knew each other pretty well by then. But, you know, one of my colleagues observed that if she had, at one of those casual, unscripted moments, done something stupid, you know, fallen on her face or, you know, said something off the cuff that was controversial, you can bet it would have been in everybody's story. So as you say, you know, it's not, you're not really cutting, you're not really giving the person any leeway. It's almost an artificial casualness. And I'm sure that she was well aware of that, that she really could never let down her guard completely, because we would all be, you know, ready to pounce if there was something to pounce on. Another one of my colleagues one day saw her yawn and, you know, and said, "Oh my God, I just realized, you know, I've been covering her for months and I never saw her yawn before." And I think that maybe gives you an indication of how guarded she was, that she was always sort of on, you know, that she was always aware that any slip up that she made would be fodder for the press. We never had an off-the-record, a sort of a formal off-the-record Q&A. It's very common for politicians. In fact, Al Gore had one when he was running for president. They'll assemble all the political reporters and they'll say, "Okay, this is just a get-to-know-you conversation, but everything here is off the record." You know, and so Al Gore, running for president, came to New York early on in the campaign. We all met at a deli. We sat around for a couple of hours. People just threw out questions and he threw out answers. And, you know, people weren't taping it. People weren't taking notes. It was just kind of get-to-know-you time. And as far as I know, nobody reported anything that was said, you know, during that conversation. And we never had anything like with Hillary that. And I asked her campaign why, and they said they could not trust that the press corps would refrain from printing something that she might say that was controversial, even if the ground rules were off the record, this is not to be printed, that they couldn't trust that we would abide by those rules, just because she is so famous and everything she says becomes fodder for someone. So that's sort of like the story of Hillary Clinton, right? I mean, everything she does, whether she says I'm running for president or she says I'll never run for president, whatever it is, it's newsworthy.
Yeah. Well, in the back of the book, there's a chapter that features voices
right.
from the women in the van. And
right.
one of them talks, I think it's Trish Durkin, if I'm reading my notes,
right.
my scribbled notes correctly, who talks about the difficulty candidates face in how something can be taken out of context and blown into all manner of weird proportion. For example, the remark that Hillary made about, you know, baking cookies
right.
is what it was.
Right.
And what Clinton was saying, what she was saying was, you know, we all have choices now, and that wasn't my choice. My
right.
choice was something else. And Trish Durkin says, you know, that got all taken out of Trish Durkin, the New York Observer,
right.
Got taken all out of context.
Right. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that section. It's actually one of my favorite parts of the book. I sort of thought that this was maybe a particularly female perspective also. I really thought that the book is written in my voice. You know, it's my first person. It's sort of my take on Hillary, my take on being a working mother, my take on the media and campaign politics and all that. But at the end of the day, I wanted to try to make the point that my take, Beth Harpaz, is not the ultimate, you know, be-all and end-all of what it's all about. And that everyone who meets Hillary or thinks about Hillary has a slightly different way of looking at her and thinking about her and experiencing what she means. So I asked some of the other women in the press corps, the other girls in the van, as it were, if they would let me interview them and if I could then write in their voices what their experience of Hillary was. And I was sort of influenced by some of those old books from the 70s, you know, Studs Terkel and you know, Gail Sheehy and people like that, who went around and interviewed a lot of people, just regular people, about their thoughts or their experiences on one thing or another. And I thought that, you know, maybe the whole, all of our different voices talking about who is Hillary, what does she mean to us, what was our sense of her, that would add up to a more complete picture than any one picture that I could present. And I thought it was interesting because a lot of the women on the van mentioned the same anecdote. In fact, there was another reporter who works for the Gannett paper here in New York City, actually in our suburbs, Westchester, Noreen O'Donnell, who also brought up that baking cookies remark. And I didn't tell, you know, each of these people, oh, the other person said blah, 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 what do you think? I just let them say whatever they wanted to say about Hillary. But it was interesting that in doing that, a couple of people picked up on the same themes. And that anecdote was one of them because, you know, as you say, she was making this sort of not real controversial statement, I don't think, about, you know, now we have choices and this is my choice, but this is a different choice. I could have stayed home and baked cookies. But taken out of context, that sentence fragment made it seem like she was very anti, you know, women who choose to stay home with their children, which I don't think is true. Hillary, you do have to be careful of what you say because things get thrown back at you in ways that you probably didn't intend them to. And as a result, she really parsed her words very carefully. Most of the time when she would answer questions, you know, she would say things that were so bland, you almost had nothing to quote from. You know, you could see she often had this sort of laugh of a response when you'd ask her something. And I came to realize that this little laugh gave her 20 seconds to kind of formulate a sort of a non-controversial answer or sort of a bland way of responding to something. I remember one day she did a wonderful tour of black churches in New York City to mobilize the black vote, which is her strongest demographic group. At one of these churches, they started singing a hymn, which normally goes, I told Satan, get thee behind. Only they changed the words to, I told Lazio, get thee behind. And at first Hillary was singing along, I told Satan, get thee behind. And then when the pastor and the congregation started changing the words to equate Satan with her opponent, Rick Lazio, you know, she kind of got this look on her face and she stopped singing because that would be a little out there. And so afterwards, after she came out of the church, she held a little press conference and I said, you know, so what'd you think of that hymn they were singing in there? And I'm thinking I'm going to get a really great quote out of this, right? And she lets this laugh roll out, and after about, you know, 15, 20 seconds of this little giggle, she just says, well, I love hymns. And that was it, you know. But I could see her brain ticking as she's trying to think, okay, how am I going to answer this in a way that's humorous, that answers the question, but not get myself into trouble by either criticizing the church for equating Satan with Lazio or, you know, appearing to agree with them that Lazio is Satan. So that was a sort of a typical Hillary working her way out of the hole.
Yeah. You know, New York and Illinois are not night and day. The two states could be viewed similarly.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that statewide candidates do in a state like Illinois that is large and diverse like New York is they adjust themselves venue to venue. Did Hillary do that?
She absolutely did. In fact, I have a funny story to share with your listeners since they are in Hillary's home state of Illinois. She grew up in Park Ridge, outside of Chicago. And of course, as everybody knows, a lot of people said, well, why didn't she go back to Illinois to run for Senate? Why didn't she wait until there was an opportunity to do it there? Why did she come to New York? It's very interesting that Hillary was the first woman to win statewide office in New York, and a friend of mine suggested that perhaps it took an out-of-stater to win in New York, precisely because of the reason that you pointed out. New York, as an electorate, is divided into downstate and upstate. Downstate is New York City, urban, ethnic, and its suburbs, you know, sort of affluent, but also ethnic. Italian, Jewish, Irish, Black, Hispanic, those are the big groups, and a growing Asian population. Upstate, it's largely rural. There are a couple of big cities, Buffalo, Rochester, Albany, Syracuse, but it's largely rural, manufacturing. We've got some universities, but it's very different from downstate. It's much more homogenous. It's much more white. And if people are, you know, ethnic, if they have an Italian last name, it's a couple generations gone by already. But there's also just a lot of WASPs, which you don't really find that in New York City. You find very few white Protestants in New York City. But what was interesting about Hillary is she would come to New York City, and on the Upper East Side, which is this very elegant neighborhood, you know, she'd put on her black pantsuit, and she'd talk about Yale, and she'd talk about Wellesley, and she'd be very sophisticated and very urbane and very Manhattan. And then she'd get on her little plane, and she'd fly on up to, you know, somewhere in upstate New York, and she'd put on a, you know, a down vest the color of a pumpkin, and, you know, or a bright blue jogging suit or something like that, a color that she would never wear in Manhattan, never. And that nobody else in Manhattan would wear either for that matter, you know, wear the original black everything. So she'd put on a bright color, and she'd, you know, to us, her Midwestern accent sounds very strong. You know, she has a different way of saying A's. She doesn't drop her R's the way we do in New York. And that Midwestern accent would become very exaggerated when she was upstate. And I remember going with her one time to Buffalo. She was greeting some people at the airport. She stood up on this little podium, and she said, "I'm from a Great Lakes state just like you," because, of course, Buffalo and Chicago mm-hmm. are both, you know, Great Lakes cities. And I just, my jaw dropped. I just thought, I have covered Hillary, you know, probably 200 times in the Bronx and Brooklyn. I have never heard her say anything about being from a Great Lakes state, but she could go upstate, and this was part of how she related to them. And, you know, typically when I would cover Hillary in New York City, you know, the other thing we don't have a lot of in New York City are real blondes. You know, you go on the subway and there's lots of dark hair and dark skin. It's just, you know, we don't have a lot of people from Scandinavian ancestry here, tend to be more, you know, Southern Europe or the Middle East or, you know, Hispanic ancestry. And often I would go with her somewhere and I'd think, you know, she's the only blonde person in the room, you know, or go to, with her to a black church. She's the only white person in the room. Go with her to a synagogue. She's the only non-Jew in the room. And then I'd go upstate and I would see that she really fit in. You know, she looked like the people upstate. She had the same sort of facial features, blue eyes, the blonde hair, the, you know, just the demeanor. You know, and she, of course, is a WASP. And I sometimes wonder if part of our problem in New York City in accepting her initially anyway was that, you know, we're used to people like Mayor Giuliani who, when he's angry, he screams and yells. And, you know, we're used to people who wear their emotions right on their face. You never have to guess what they're thinking about. And Hillary does have a more natural sort of reserve, which, you know, to me as a New Yorker, that seems very Midwestern because in New York we're just pushy and we say whatever we think, you know, needs to be said. We don't have layers of politeness or whatever. So I think that she was, you know, a chameleon-like in her dealings with upstate and downstate. And as people have, this one friend of mine said to me, maybe, you know, maybe other female candidates like Jerry Ferraro, also extremely famous female celebrity politician type who did try to run for Senate and failed to even make it past the primary, perhaps she just seemed too New York City for upstaters to accept. She comes from Queens, has a Queens accent. And maybe it took someone from somewhere else to come here and say, okay, I can be one way when I'm in New York City and another way when I'm upstate. And, you know, you're suggesting that politicians in Illinois have to do the same thing. I wonder if our standards might not even be higher for women because we also judge them based on how they dress and how they do their hair and, you know, some things that we don't always look at that closely when we are judging male politicians.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think that those things are up for more scrutiny if the candidate is a woman than if she's a man.
Because, absolutely.
I've seen men running for political office or trying to get some measure passed through the state house or Congress or whatever, and they're very different if they're appearing before a labor hall than they are if they're appearing before the Rotary,
right.
Let's just say.
Absolutely.
Let's talk with a listener. Beth Harpaz is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about covering Hillary Clinton in the Senate campaign, the U.S. Senate campaign. Beth is the author of The Girls in the Van, covering Hillary. Let's talk with a listener on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. Since you're talking in the Midwest now, I was just wondering if you had any stories to tell about two people, and one you've already mentioned, Giuliani. He wanted that Senate seat, I gather. And then Peggy Noonan, who wrote a book about Hillary, and I'll hang up and hope you have something, a tidbit to say about those. Thanks.
Thank you for calling. I actually loved Peggy Noonan's book. I mean, obviously, she's coming at Hillary from a, you know, Republican perspective, former speechwriter for Ronald Reagan. You know, I try to read all the Hillary books, the Hillary hate books, the Hillary love books. I tried to write a neutral book in that, you know, if Hillary had a bad day, I wrote about it. If Hillary had a good day, I wrote about it. But, you know, when I read Peggy's book, I read it in the middle of Hillary's campaign, and I thought to myself that I finally understood what was going on with the media in Hillary's campaign, because I think up until that point, until I read Peggy's book, I was sort of taking it all personally, like, why can't I get my questions answered? Why can't I get my calls returned? And then, you know, in Peggy's book, which is a very funny, very smart book, she, you know, she sort of says, listen, the Clintons hate the media, Hillary and Bill, neither one of them. They don't trust the media. The media has done nothing but make trouble for them. You know, to them it is a game. They do whatever they can to control the media. And I finally, the light bulb, when I was like, oh, okay, it's not about me. This is just how the Clintons deal with the media. And as far as Mayor Giuliani goes, you know, I mean, I would not want to take anything away from the people who have lauded his performance since September 11th in bringing New York City together. I mean, it's just, it's been a very difficult time to live here. Every day has, you know, had its challenges. And he's done an incredible job of just being there for all of us. I mean, I remember the very first night I was in the newsroom, and, you know, he held a press conference, and he said, you know, the losses will be more than any of us can bear. And that sentence has echoed in my mind, you know, every day since then. You know, but on the other hand, you know, why did he drop out? Why didn't he keep running for Senate? Mm-hmm. Well, on the face of it, we were told he had prostate cancer. But, of course, there are lots of people who had prostate cancer and kept doing what they were doing. Joe Torre led the Yankees to victory. Robert Dole, you know, ran for office after he had prostate cancer. There were a lot of other things going on, and we shouldn't be naive to think that prostate cancer was the number one reason he dropped out. He had marital problems. He was having a relationship, and still is, with a woman not his wife, Judy Nathan. He had a lot of problems in the city of New York. He had a lot of First Amendment lawsuits pending against him. You know, we in New York, we like people who speak their mind, and to give him, to give Rudy Giuliani credit, he has always said exactly what he thought, even if everybody disagreed with him. But you'll probably remember, at one point he tried to shut down the Brooklyn Museum of Art because he didn't like an art exhibit there. People come to New York because they want artistic expression, they want their culture, they want it raw, they want it in every form they can get it, and people didn't like that. And he also had a lot of problems dealing with the minority community. We had had a series of very high-profile police brutality incidents involving white cops and unarmed black men, and he had very poor relations with the black community. And Hillary was really exploiting those aspects of his, you know, of his administration, using them to her benefit. And I think at some point he just decided, I don't want to be senator. You know, I don't want to go to Washington and have to negotiate with 99 other people. He really is more suited to be a chief executive, a top-down kind of guy. And there are rumors that he may run for governor at some point if Pataki, for whatever reason, doesn't want to run for re-election. And I think probably a lot of people, even people who love Rudy Giuliani, think he's better suited to a governor-mayor type of position than a senator-congressman type.
Hmm. We're out of time, but before we go, I want to ask you, do you think Hillary Clinton will run for president one of
these
days?
That's the question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, she claims no. On Meet the Press on Sunday, she was fairly firm about it. No matter which way Tim Russert asked the question, she seemed to be saying no, no, no. Frankly, I don't see why she wouldn't. I doubt she would do it in 2004. I think that's too soon. But I don't know why she would not run if it made sense to run at some later time, you know, 2008 or further on. She showed what you can do when you mobilize women voters. That's how she was elected. She got Republican women to vote for her, as well as Democrats. And if she were able to do that nationally, I don't see why she would, you know, deny herself that opportunity if it looked right at some point down the road.
Hmm. Do you think people are studying Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign and looking at it very closely in terms of, you know, what what works and what
I mean, I'm afraid they're not. I mean, look, we had a Democratic mayoral candidate lose to a Republican in a town where Democratic registration outnumbers Republican 5-1. I think Hillary did two things that Democrats should really take note of. One is she did not take the minority vote for granted. She worked for those black votes, and she got them. She went to every church. She went to black neighborhoods where I have never seen a white politician go. She was, you know, she was really sincere about connecting with the black community on issues that mattered to them and not just having it be like 5 minutes of FaceTime at the two most famous churches. And the other thing she did was women. She didn't just go after Democratic women, women who she knew supported her. She went to neutral settings, you know, a fundraiser for breast cancer, a meeting of the National Council of Jewish Women, where she knew she would be meeting women who didn't like her, women who were Republican, women who didn't support her for whatever reason. And she knew she would have an opportunity to persuade them to talk about issues that matter to them, and it worked. And, you know, not only Democrats, Republicans should take note, because we have some wonderful Republican female politicians out there, senators from Maine and other places. And the women's vote can be mobilized across party lines if you do it carefully, and Hillary did a very good job of studying that and making it work.
Beth, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
Beth Harpaz has been our guest this afternoon. Look for her book, The Girls in the Van, Covering Hillary. It is published by St. Martin's Press.